He who has a thing to sell and goes and whispers in a well is not so apt to get the dollars as she who climbs a tree and hollers. And so we ask, how does one win the minds and dollars of those who eat food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the Food Chain Radio Show podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Kowloon who are tuned into the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with intern producer Vanessa Salas on the stories, and she has a good one for us today, ladies and gentlemen. Folks, much of our food now comes from far, far away, where it was grown, processed, and packaged with mysterious technologies by complete strangers. Therefore, when it comes to knowing what we should buy to eat and what we should not buy, we city people are pretty much babes in the woods. As babes in the woods, we need a mother to tell us what in all of those colorful plastic bags that line the grocer's shelves we should buy and eat, or not buy and eat, as the case may be. Trouble is, everyone wants us to buy what they have to sell, and they want to be our mother. And so we babes in the woods are continually assaulted with messages that say, buy this, or this. No, no, don't buy that. Buy this. What should we babes in the woods trust to be our mother? And so today we pause to ask, how does one win the minds and dollars of those who eat food? How do people become that mother we can trust? Well, who better to ask than one of the very big winners of the being a mother race, Macy Gansler, who is a chief strategy and brand officer of Bon Appetit Management Company and the author of You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime. Macy, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be back again.
It's great to have you back again. You know, in way back in Food Chain number 1026, we talked about what consumers should be allowed to know about how their food was grown. And, of course, we were talking about the videotaping of animal feedlots and processing facilities and how it's really easy to make them look bad when it gets right down to it. And so there was a lot of contention over whether we should be allowed to see that process. That's what we were talking about then. Now we're going to be talking about your 30-year career with Bon Appetit Management Company and your career of telling us babes in the woods what and how we should eat our food when it gets right down to it. So you have such an incredible career at Bon Appetit, which to me is a real blessing to the world, because having been raised on institutional food in the Navy and in schools and whatever, it was always the worst food in the world because it was literally lifeless. And you folks at Bon Appetit figured out how to put life back into food and serve that food in institutions. Is that pretty much the core of what you did?
It is. I would make one little adjustment in terms of the idea that we're telling people what they should eat, but maybe instead giving people information so they can make food choices that meet their goals and their values, because we're not all after the same thing for what would make the most sense is living on our plates.
Okay. Well, I still think of you as a mother, though. So we are babes in the woods when it gets down to food, we really don't know. And to have everybody telling us what to do, we all have to find a voice we can trust. And yours has been one of those trustworthy voices for me over the years. So that's, you're stuck with being a food mom for me.
Thank you. A role I will take with honor.
In thinking of your career, you had two kinds of jobs, two essential marketing jobs. One was really to sell the world on good food, as you saw it, as you see it. And the other was to sell the world on using the services of Bon Appetit, which provides the world with the food you believe is good. So you have two different marketing jobs, as I see it. Is that a fair assessment?
It is. Luckily, they both come together in one important aspect, and that is taste. We have to start with great tasting food. And food that is grown locally by farmers who care about flavor and biodiversity, that is picked by people who are treated well and therefore treat the products well, by animals that are given good lives and killed in a more humane way, tastes better. And people want to buy food and buy food from a company that makes food that tastes better. So that's the commonality between those two roles you outlined.
Very good. And they come together in a very good place. As I mentioned earlier, had a lot of experience in my life in eating institutional food. I guess the best example of that is the food served on a Navy ship, which can be made to taste good if you use a half bottle of Tabasco sauce. But that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about food that intrinsically tastes good because it is good food. And in your career at Bon Appetit, you led a number of crusades, of food crusades, as I see them. One, and let me kind of go through the list really quickly so people can get an idea of the depth of your service to the good food community. You campaigned on the farm to fork concept. You campaigned on the reducing the use of antibiotics in poultry, cage-free chickens, gestation crates, and perfectly delicious vegetables, which I love, by the way. Eat local, which of course is my favorite, and low carbon lifestyle. Do all of these things have a commonality?
Well, I think first of all, they start with values. And that's something really important to us at Bon Appetit. I had a chef say to me once, I get to bring my values to work, and that means the world to me. This is how I'd like to feed my family, and it's great to be able to feed our guests in this way. So I think that they start with values-driven decisions and, again, great-tasting food. But at Bon Appetit, we really learned the power of our purchasing decisions, that we could make a difference for people, we could make a difference for communities, we could make a difference in the environment by how we spent our money. And that seems pretty elementary now, but the Farm to Fork program started for us back in 1999. And it was really an awakening that business could be used in a very intentional way to make change. And that's what my book is about. You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime. It speaks to the duality of wanting to make real change for the environment, in the case of that line, how manure is handled, but also build a business upon it, marketing. It's the marriage of both.
It's almost as if you're preaching food morality.
There was a wonderful man named Brother Dave Andrews who ran the National Catholic Rural Life Center. And he had a campaign called Eating is a Moral Act. How did you know Brother Dave?
I met him at a conference in which I was giving a speech. It was a Catholic Rural Life Conference, somewhere in the boondocks of Missouri. And another person I met at that conference, I was right across the street, I got up early and went over for breakfast, and there was a farmer sitting at the table, and the only person in the restaurant. So I thought, oh, I'll sit with him. And sat down, and turned out his name was Percy Smizer. And Percy started telling me this incredible story about his war with Monsanto up in Canada. So at the same conference, I got to meet Brother Dave and Percy Smizer. So it was kind of a fun conference.
That's pretty amazing. Was Percy Smyser the farmer who got sued for stealing the Monsanto products that he didn't want anyway, that were ruining his crops? Really an icon.
And so he told me this story over coffee and breakfast.
That's cool.
So I followed him with my Food Chain radio show for a number of years. We became very close over the course of that time. Because anybody, he's like you. He is fighting this moral war for good food. And anybody's doing that is a friend of mine. So let's turn now quickly to your book. Not too quickly, because I think we're going to be bringing Bon Appetit with us as we move along. But your book is titled, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime. So can you give us just a real minute or two thumbnail on that before we go to our break?
Yeah, so the book is a practical how-to guide for anyone that wants to build a brand authentically based on sustainability. Doesn't matter what industry you're in or the size of your company, if you want to go to market featuring sustainability at the heart of your brand, this book will give you the steps to do so.
You're a marketing warrior, aren't you? Sometimes when I give a seminar on marketing, I always ask the people in the class for a one-word synonym for marketing. And after some say advertising and some say publicity and some say this and some say that, all of which are part of marketing, but none of which encompass everything that is marketing. So when the crowd is about ready to throw rotten tomatoes at me, I always say my one word for marketing is fighting. And when people hire me to market for them, they're really asking me to fight for them. Mm. Or, if you want a more polite word, contend. And as I look at your career at Bon Appetit, I think somebody was very clever to have hired you to fight for them.
Thank you.
Is that a fair word for what you did for them?
Well, I certainly think that to take on all of these issues did require a lot of fighting or crusading, as you said earlier. And sometimes it meant being a pain in the butt, but being a pain in the butt all aimed at a good cause.
There you go. A happy warrior. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Macy Gansler. Oh boy, we're going to talk about building a brand, how you do that, and why should you do that. Do stay tuned, we will be right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And with Macy Gansler, Chief Strategy and Brand Officer, Bon Appetit for 30 years. Just retired, but not really retired. But stepping back a little bit, writing a book, and You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime, in which she presents five very good lessons for building a brand. But before we start building that brand, I simply must ask, what do you mean by you can't market manure at lunchtime, Macy?
Well, the title of the book refers to the opening story, which is where my CEO, Fidel Baccio, who was a great compatriot on these crusades for better food and institutional food service, was actually called out by our pork supplier because he had been out around the country badmouthing them. Kind of funny to badmouth your own supplier, but he wanted them to do better on a number of environmental issues, including manure lagoons. And the sustainability representative from this pork supplier flew out to see us to see how he could get Fidel to be maybe a little more quiet. Fidel said, you have to make change around these manure lagoons. And he was really fired up and wanting to make purchasing decisions based upon the proper handling of manure. And I was sitting in that meeting and I was really proud of Fidel and I was so excited that he wanted to make good environmental change. But I was also thinking, you can't market manure at lunchtime, right? We fundamentally sell lunch. And how are we going to get market credit for these environmental changes? I couldn't imagine a poster that you put up in a cafe that would say, this BLT was raised with better treatment of poop, you know. So the kind of tongue-in-cheek title, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime, refers to the goal of both making meaningful change, but also being able to market it.
And that, in its own way, is a spectacular example of a good marketing problem. How do you do that? What did you do? How did you address it?
Well, it turned out that just changing that one aspect, manure legumes, wasn't really possible. We wound up having to make a much larger change, so large as to actually change suppliers. And the new supplier, in addition to doing a better job with the treatment of manure, was also doing a better job with the treatment of the animals. And most specifically, not putting sows in gestation crates. A gestation crate is a metal pen that a pregnant sow is confined to for her entire pregnancy, 3 weeks, 3 months, and 3 days, so almost 4 months. The pen is so small that she can't turn around, she can't walk, she can only look forward at the prescribed amount of food that has been determined that is the most efficient for her to eat, and she can lay down. She spends 4 months essentially immobilized. And that inhumane treatment really does resonate with customers, maybe in a way that manure legumes don't. So when we did the marketing piece, we talked a lot more about how the sows were being treated well and not confined to gestation crates. And we didn't talk so much about the manure legumes. Mm-hmm.
And that crusade did not stop with Bon Appetit.
It did not. In fact, there have been two really important legislative moves. California and Massachusetts have banned the sale of pork raised using gestation crates in both of those states. And being that the California market in particular is so large, that has great ripple effects.
Great ripple effect. How did you go about addressing this morality to your institutional food buyers?
Well, at Bon Appetit Management Company, we made a number of decisions about the way we were going to source food. And that was not optional for our customers. So a customer couldn't say, well, we want the pork from gestation crates, or we don't care about caged hens, we'll take the caged eggs. What they could opt out of was the marketing of it. So we didn't have to talk about it in the cafes. As it turned out, the overwhelming majority of our customers did want us to market those more sustainable decisions because their customers cared.
And that made a difference to them. You know, again, I go back to, you know, that deep institutional food of a Navy ship. And I think even there, it would have made a big difference for the sailors on the ship to know that somebody cared about how their food was being processed and grown. Even with a bottle of Tabasco sauce to make the difference, you know, it would still make a difference. And so you are doing these two marketing wars, one for, you know, the morality of how we're growing food, and the other for changing the institutional nature of food at the same time. Or did it even make a difference to you that they were two different worlds?
Well, I saw one as informing the other. So in 1987, when Bon Appetit was founded by Fidel Baccio, it was very much that food that you remember in institutions,
right.
Which was mystery meat and canned green beans and everything cooked before lunchtime and just put out in big pans and steam tables, and they just got more and more limp and soggy as the meal went on. And what Fidel's idea was putting a real executive chef into each kitchen that bought and cooked fresh food just as a restaurant would, a la minute or at the last minute. And that was in 1987 when he had that grand idea and brought real food to the institutional marketplace. I joined the company in 1994, and together we went on this journey of awakening to realizing about the power of our food purchases, about sustainability, about how that affected taste, and that word that you used, which is really critical, care, that people would care if they knew that we cared for them in our cooking and that we cared for the community in which they lived and that we cared for the people that were in the supply chain, farm workers, and the animals. They feel that care, and people will therefore buy your product.
I always think the best food is food with its farmer's face on it, because you can look into the farmer's eyes and see what's in the food. And that's pretty much exactly what you're talking about. If you can convey somehow that care that you're putting into the food, people will pick up on that and appreciate their food much, much more.
In the book, I interviewed 12 people, including Chris Arnold, who was the head of communications for Chipotle. And he talked about one of the most iconic marketing campaigns in food ever, which was a short film they made called Back to the Start, which told the story of a hog farmer, Russ Kramer, and his journey of going away from the traditional family farming practices to a more industrial model using antibiotics, and realizing his own error of his thinking and going back to the start, back to the traditional way of raising pigs. And that movie was shown during the Grammys. I don't know if you remember that moment. It was a really watershed moment in food marketing. And it was putting that farmer face, just as you said, onto quick service food, the place where you would least expect it.
But what a message to convey. Yeah. And especially if it has some semblance of reality, people will buy it then. So you offer 5 different lessons in You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime. And it's probably you can't when it gets right down to it. So you picked out some very significant people in the food industry, of which you were one. And you talk about learn how to pick your battles. And that was your great story about the pig gestation crates. So I'd like to pick up quickly Bon Appetit itself. I guess you talked about that with respect to Fidel and his efforts to make a change. What I'd like to comment on that was a significant financial step to step up to purchasing a real chef for the kitchen, instead of somebody who just heats and serves.
Absolutely. And you hit on a really important piece, that sometimes people would assume that the food costs would be more expensive because we're using fresh ingredients. In fact, processed food is often more expensive than fresh, but the labor cost is higher to have talented, skilled people in the kitchen.
Because it takes talent to make real food, fresh food, work. Whereas something that comes in a can, you just open the can and pour it in the pot, and there it is. I was eating at a local restaurant, which was convenient for meeting people, but it's one of those open a package and heat up restaurants. And I was thinking of Bon Appetit, how I could make that revolutionary change at this restaurant so I would enjoy it going there. But good luck on that. Another one that you talk about is Whole Foods, which really, Walter Robb really did make an existential leap in grocery stores.
Walter Robb was co-CEO of Whole Foods for many, many years, working very closely with John Mackey, the founder. And one of the stories that he told me that I thought was really interesting was that the most contentious issue they ever had in the executive team for Whole Foods was what should Whole Foods do about genetically modified ingredients? And that there was not debate on whether they thought GMOs were good or bad, but about what they should do about it. Should they ban it from their stores? Well, they already had this great emphasis on organic, and organic already disallows genetically modified ingredients. Would making a statement against GMOs be making a statement against science? And he talked about, as they debated, their own team members and the public were looking to them for an answer, that Whole Foods had become kind of the arbiter of what was sustainable and what was good in food production.
The mother.
And that it, absolutely, the mother, to your point. And that the longer it took, the more unrest there was. And they finally settled on that customers should know, things should be labeled, and that their own brand, their Whole 365, would not have genetically modified ingredients. But it was interesting to me that there was such debate and that they took their time to make the right decision, even though there was all of this external pressure.
Wow. The activist as allies.
In the first lesson, when I talk about picking your issue, I talk about that activists are actually your allies. And I had originally titled that section, "Keep Your Enemies Close." Oh, wait, you don't have any enemies. And I think that's to try to counteract the knee-jerk reaction that many people have in the corporate food world, that when an activist organization, be it the Humane Society or PETA, comes knocking on your door, that that's bad news, that you should run scared, that you should close down and try to be secret. And that gets at that whole issue around ag gag laws and not letting people see what's going on. But in fact, I have found that when you invite those people in, there's incredible benefit. First of all, they're really knowledgeable.
Because they've been studying. Well, if you're in the animal husbandry business, maybe raising beef, pork, chickens, whatever, and PETA walks in the door, boy, you're going to start shaking. Your knees are going to knock, I guess. But Macy Gensler says, no, listen. What do they tell you, Macy?
Well, if PETA knocks at your door, what you now have is access to a expert on what a certain percent of your customers want. You have access to a free PR machine, actually, because if you work with PETA or with Greenpeace and you do something together, they will publicize it in a way that is more credible and authentic than any press release you could put out for yourself. When we eliminated plastic straws, Greenpeace actually gave us a quote for the press release. And that holds so much weight with cynical consumers that wonder if people are just, if companies are just greenwashing. But if Greenpeace or PETA is the one that's endorsing your action, automatically you've got great credibility and a much more interesting story that a reporter will want to write about.
Hmm. It's like a boxer having a good opponent, almost. Mm-hmm. It makes everybody look good.
Right.
And
you rise to the occasion.
Good. And all of these things, of course, fit into how to build a brand. And you, as I mentioned earlier, you're building a brand for your management company, and not only Bon Appetit, but also for good food in general. So holding up two things in your marketing efforts, and you're fighting for both of them, of course. And what a magnificent war. One of my favorite, of course, is learning how to tell your story, because as a storyteller, that's what we all strive to do, is a good job of telling your story. So first of all, the first job of any good storyteller is to capture attention. And of course, you start right off by capturing attention with the title of your book, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime, which captured my attention.
Good.
And there it is. And here you are, clever girl. And so tell us about the whole job of learning how to tell your story. We have a young intern here from the University of California. And what you have to offer would be immensely of value to her and to all of the students who are coming up in the world, because we all have to sell our story to get anywhere. You're the master or mistress of good stories. So where do we begin?
Well, you begin with getting your story straight. And especially when you're talking about sustainability, there's a lot of scientific terms and complicated words, things that are actually physically difficult to say. And gestation crates, it's a mouthful. So you start by getting your story right. I was actually at a restaurant a couple nights ago, and the server said something about the chicken breast. It was a very large chicken breast. And he said, "This chicken isn't pumped full of hormones like other chicken." And I thought, ooh, he doesn't have his story straight. Actually, in the U.S., the FDA does not allow the use of hormones to be artificially injected into chickens. So no chicken has artificial hormones. Your beef is a different story, but not for chickens. So right when he said that, he lost me. He lost credibility. My ears shut. Right? You want to make sure that you're not doing the same thing when you're telling your story. So at Bon Appetit, we spend a lot of time educating people on what the issues are, what the terms mean, and how to use them correctly in online trainings, as well as in person and monthly webcasts.
Kind of like using a handgun. You better know how to use it or you'll shoot yourself in the foot. Now, I'm curious, when the waiter told you that the chicken breast has no hormones in it, did you respond to him?
I didn't, because I was sitting at a table with four other people, and I don't think that a teaching moment is paired well with an embarrassing moment.
Right.
If I were to go back to that restaurant and had a moment to talk to him just one-on-one, I would probably share the information, but I don't think calling him out at the table would have been effective.
Yeah, not when you're sitting with a bunch of other people, that's for sure. But you're right, when you hear something like that, a piece of misinformation like that, well, that's a piece of information too.
It sure is.
It's a piece of information that tells you we're being misinformed by somebody.
Mm-hmm. So that's the first step. And then I think the second one is to figure out what your news hook is. One of the things that I ran into a lot with Bon Appetit, as our reputation grew for having great food and having a great supply chain, is that the story of good company does something good is not really a news hook, right? That's not news.
Everything is okay. Everything is going right. There's no news here or something like that.
Exactly. Like you're saying, no news here. So we have to find a way to package the story so that there is some controversy or some tension. We'd always say, where's the tension in the story? And for Bon Appetit, that tension often came from where our food was served. You know, as you've said, it was an institutional food service. Mm-hmm. So the surprise of these great ingredients and these great chefs being in a college cafeteria. In fact, Mark Bittman, when he was in the New York Times, wrote a story about Bon Appetit. He called our food that should be served with wine, after having dined at the cafe at the University of San Francisco with me. And so that was our tension often of the surprise of where you're finding this good food. Or we would take a negative and turn it into a positive. One of our other challenges was the reporters would say, well, where can people go eat your food? And they'd have to say, nowhere, nothing's open to the public, because Bon Appetit is an institutional food service provider, served food in places that were closed, private colleges, corporate headquarters. And so that negative of the public can't get there, they turned into a positive of take a peek behind the curtain. What are the people at these high-tech companies that you always hear about really eating? Let you in on the secret of it. So once you get your story straight, then you've got to figure out your news hook.
Very good. And the next step?
And then you've got to figure out where to tell that story.
Ah.
In the old days, you'd put out a press release. There were reporters that would respond. Well, the media landscape has changed, would be the understatement of the century, right? Fewer and fewer local reporters, fewer and fewer even food sections at major newspapers. Somehow, strangely, the 24-hour news cycle has made it harder to get coverage. And so I would say to my team, how can we tell our story without having to bounce it off of the Wall Street Journal? Meaning, can we speak directly to the people that we want to hear our story versus trying to get this intermediary of media to do it for us? And so it becomes things like blogs and social media and newsletters and op-eds in newspapers. So you're writing your own story, but getting it published in a newspaper.
And we all know that the media has to be fed all the time.
It sure does.
So if you're very clever, you'll know that, and you feed them what you want to feed them.
And feed them on an ongoing basis. There was a reporter at Bloomberg that I worked with for over a year before I was ever quoted by her. I became her go-to person to just kind of work out her thoughts around the gestation crate issue. If she wanted to ground truth what other people were telling her, she could call me and I'd say, that makes sense to me, or this doesn't seem logical. Go back and look in this area a little more. I was really a true source for her, and that eventually got me the quote.
And once you're in with her, you're with her.
Mm-hmm.
So she calls you back and you become a good source. Very good.
And the last piece to that is working on crafting the quote, being truly quotable, understanding what the story is about, what the reporter's after, and giving them the soundbite that they need.
For example, the title of your book, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime. Surely you must have had some good feedback on that.
Well, I did have the moment where my boyfriend said to me, you mean excrement is in the title of your book? And I said, yeah, caught your eye, didn't it?
Very good. And you have a couple of good writers, one of which was David Kinch, which is a favorite of mine, and Love Apple Farms. So what did David have to say?
Well, David has a kind of counterintuitive approach to storytelling. And we talked about that a lot. He said at one point in our interview, unfortunately, they got known as a farm-to-table restaurant. And it was like, why was that a bad thing? You know, why was that unfortunate? So many people are trying to be known for that. And David really sees the storytelling as being what's on the plate, not what's written in the menu. In fact, the menu is only given to you at the end of the meal at Manresa, which was his three Michelin starred restaurant.
And that's certainly counterintuitive to tell you what you've eaten after you've eaten it.
And the menu descriptors were very bare. Now, on the flip side of the menu was a map and the names of the producers, because he was certainly proud of that and he understood the importance. he says that you can't make great food without great ingredients. It goes against the laws of physics. So he certainly takes great care in the sourcing and wants to celebrate the producers, but he doesn't think that's got to be the first thing you hear when you sit down at the table. The first thing he wants is for you to have the sensual experience of eating, create your own memory, and that to become your story, which will be even more meaningful than anything a server could tell you.
Instagram photos, right?
Right.
Yeah. Wow. So 30 years of building a brand. Your most memorable moment?
I would say that my most memorable moment was when we did a national road show and went across the country in order to look all of our chefs and managers in the eye and tell them that the company was making this shift from our sustainability efforts being behind the scenes to being forefront, and we're going to start talking about it. It was really critical to our success that we were already doing many of these things as practice. We already had the Farm to Fork program in place. We were already committed to Seafood Watch. We were already working on reducing antibiotics in meat production. And then we started marketing it. So marketing wasn't driving operations, but that roadshow to get to go out and deliver that news to an audience of chefs and managers who were so excited about this change. And as I said before, said things like, I get to bring my values to work. And that means so much to me. I'd say that's one of the highlights of my career.
A great team building effort.
An incredible recruitment and retention tool. Sustainability really goes a long way internally.
And now you're stepping back as a full-time person at Bon Appetit, and you're out going out to sell your book. But what's next? Because once you're a warrior, right?
Well, as you've said, I was at Bon Appetit full-time for 30 years, and I feel so incredibly lucky to have found a home for that long. But what it also meant was that I really concentrated on one industry, food service, specifically institutional food service. And along the last few years, I've had an opportunity to do some board service. I sit on the board of a really interesting company called Air Protein, which makes protein actually from the molecules of air. It's a fermentation technology using hydrogen. And to sit on the advisory boards of a few other companies. And it's been great fun to get to stretch my wings and translate those lessons that I learned from Bon Appetit into other markets. And so that's what spurred me to write the book. And what I'd like to continue to do more of is working with entrepreneurs or even late stage companies that want to explore this area of sustainability in a new way. So in an advisory role.
Well, Macy Gansler, we want to thank you for joining us on the Food Chain Radio program. And we hope that you continue the good fight for good food. And the world needs you. And I need you to come back with another story, which I'm sure you will. And thank you all out there. And thank Vanessa for joining us and bringing this story to us. Vanessa Salas. And we want to thank you all out there and ask that you remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, which is cheap food isn't. Thank you all.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.